Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the bravest thing you've ever done, and how did it change you? By the time Cheryl Strayed was 26, she had endured a series of devastating losses. Her father was gone by the time she was 6 years old. Her beloved mother had died of cancer when Strayed was a senior in college. Her marriage to a good man had been undone by her own infidelities and heroin use. And her once promising writing career had given way to a series of dead-end jobs. Without knowing exactly why, Strayed was drawn to the idea of hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, a 2,600-mile path that stretches from Mexico to Canada. With little hiking experience and even less understanding of why she needed to go, Strayed struggled into a very heavy pack and set off in 1995 on a solo hike that took her more than 1,100 miles over the trail in 100 days. Cheryl Strayed shares her experiences in her new memoir, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Cheryl, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I think it's amazing that you found out the Pacific Crest Trail even existed only about 7 months before you set off. Can you talk about what made you think you wanted to hike it?
It was really one of those moments, I think, that we all have a few times in a lifetime where you just get this feeling that this is something that you must do. Mm-hmm. I was standing in line at an outdoor store called REI when I saw a guidebook called The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California. And I really just very randomly plucked it off the shelf and read the back. And it sounded so amazing. I think a lot of your listeners, when you hear that there's this trail that, you know, stretches from border to border in our great nation, a whole bunch of them probably thought, oh, I'd like to do that someday. And I think that was, you know, really my first thought when I read that. And I was also, as you mentioned, I was in a very difficult time in my life. I was feeling desperate, and I was feeling like I needed something that would gather me. Hmm. And I thought maybe it might be the trail that would do that.
And you did prepare to go, but I suppose in some ways maybe you can never be entirely prepared for a trip of this magnitude.
That's right. It's kind of like, you know, when you're pregnant with your first child and you go to Babies R Us and you get all the gear you need.
Yeah.
And you're all set up. But then the baby arrives and you realize that there's a whole other dimension. And that was very much what happened in my planning for the Pacific Crest Trail. I bought all the outdoor things I needed. I, you know, mapped out my trip. But I had no idea really what it would be like. I had never gone backpacking a night before I began on the Pacific Crest Trail. I didn't really prepare myself physically. I wasn't going and, you know, working out and going on shorter hikes to sort of prepare for the rigors of the trail. So it wasn't until the first day I was out there that I quickly understood that this journey that was going to be something different than I expected.
So I want to talk about your losing your mom. It was just a month and a half after she was diagnosed with lung cancer that she died, and she was only 45 at the time. I was struck, though, by the fact that, you know, you describe your relationship with her and the things you knew about her. In so many ways, you seem to have known your mother better at that very young point in your life than I think a lot of people ever do throughout the course of a normal lifespan.
I think that's really true, and for that, I've always felt fortunate. I even knew that back then when my mom was dying. I remember, you know, I was really helping take care of her when she was sick, and, you know, it was just a couple weeks that she was sick before she died. Like you said, she died very quickly, but there wasn't this sense that I had to ask her everything about her life because it was my last chance. There was so much I had already asked her. I'd always been an inquisitive child. And my mother was also the kind of mother who was very open. She really wanted to have a sort of emotionally open relationship with me and my brother and sister, and she did. And so I, you know, when I was helping her die, we talked about old things, but there was so much I already knew about her, and I feel so blessed for that because I do. I'm 43 now, and I have many friends who will never really know their parents, and their parents are still alive.
The really sad thing in her life was that it ended just at the moment that, in many ways, for the first time in her adult life, she was doing something that was for her and only her.
That's right. She was, like me, she was a senior in college. When I applied to go to college, I was accepted at this place called the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. And when I got my acceptance letter, it said, "One of the benefits of going here is that your parents and grandparents can take classes for free." And I think that the university thought, well, you know, somebody will take a introduction to Spanish class or something. But what happened, in a sort of roundabout way, my mother said jokingly at first, well, I've always wanted to go to college. And she had, you know, she had gotten married at 19. And by the age of 26, she had three kids. And soon after that, she was a single mother. And she never had the opportunity to go to college. And so even though I was a surly teenager, and the idea of having my mother on campus with me didn't sound very good, I also really wanted my mom to get what she wanted in her life. And so we made an agreement, and she went to college with me. She traveled 3 hours each way from our home in northern Minnesota and attended classes full-time at St. Thomas for our freshman year. And our agreement was that, you know, and I lived on campus in the dorms, mm-hmm. and our agreement was that if I didn't address her, she was not to address me, which is, I know it sounds terrible now, but, you know, I was 17. And it worked out, and she went and was a wonderful student, got straight A's. And even though she really thought that she would probably flunk out, the contrary was true. And then after that first year, we both transferred to different universities, and she went to one closer to home, and I went to one in Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota. And she was about to graduate. We were both about to graduate when she died. She died on the spring break of our senior year, the Monday of our spring break. Her funeral was on that Friday, and then I went back to school the following week. And she did get her degree posthumously. The University of Minnesota granted her her degree afterwards.
But it wasn't just losing your mom, because in a lot of really fundamental ways, your entire nuclear family sort of broke apart, including the stepfather who had raised you very lovingly was sort of done after she died.
Yeah. Yeah, I had, you know, I did have a happy family during those teen years, and a stepfather I loved very much and still love. But, you know, I think that, and I've heard this from readers really across the nation, that this happens a lot, when, especially when a mother dies, that the family really can't sustain itself. And that was a great surprise to me. I didn't know then how much power my mother had in terms of creating our family and sustaining our family. That togetherness. And after she died, I tried to step into her place. I tried to be the person who made, you know, the family dinner on Easter, or, you know, to try to get us together. But, you know, it's a truism of grief that we all grieve differently. It took me years to come to grips with that and let go of my sorrow around that. But, you know, my stepfather, I think he did love us, but he really couldn't continue to be the father that he had been for us. And, you know, so he sort of fell away. And my siblings and I, we were all, you know, we were in our early 20s and late teens. And we loved each other, but we sort of wandered into our own lives in ways that sort of disconnected us rather than connected us.
You had married yourself at a very young age, and you write with this, I think, amazing solicitude about your first husband, Paul, even, you know, in cases where there is an amicable divorce. Did you recognize at the time that your, for lack of a better word, really bad behavior during your marriage was related to your grief for your mom?
I think that I knew that it was somewhat related. I mean, I think really in retrospect, looking back all these years, you know, I had married too young, and that probably, even though, you know, I had a lot of love for my ex-husband and he for me, we probably wouldn't have made it ultimately, and probably didn't have any business being married to each other. I wasn't ready for that just in general. But what happened is when my mother died and my family fell apart, I really had to remake myself in the world and had to find a way to live in a world without my mother, which was this radically deep and primal and, you know, enormous thing. And so I couldn't, on top of that, also sustain a marriage that was already kind of, you know, too young to sustain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's in retrospect that I can sort of see all that with in its entirety, with a sense of forgiveness for myself, for the mistakes I made, as well as, you know, fully holding myself accountable. But, you know, I think one of the most painful things during that time for me was this strange paradox that I was, you know, at the time my ex-husband really was the stable figure in my life. He was the only person who stood by me and really offered me love, unconditional love, you know, and he was the person I had to leave. And it was just something I had to do. It was searingly painful. It was a great heartbreak. I had to break my own heart in order to remake myself in the world without my mother.
Was there any element of taking on this trip that felt to you like a penance, even when you were getting it ready to go?
I don't think when I was getting ready to go, though once I got out there and I understood that I was going to be physically punished,
yeah.
It wasn't then that I understood that dimension of the trip. My first impulse when I went out there is I really thought I was going to go on a spiritual quest.
Mm-hmm.
And my image of that was I sort of forgot about the physical aspects of the trip, which sounds odd, but you know, I really was really focused on the solitude, the beauty of the natural world, being alone with myself in the wild. And I was thinking that I would be, you know, weeping upon beautiful sunsets and feeling all of this emotional growth. When I got out there, I realized that the challenge was physical and the problems were logistical. And, you know, where to find water, how to get over this mountain, how to carry this pack that I couldn't even lift. Those were the questions of the day and of the week and of the month and of those 100 days. And so it took me out of that emotional suffering, you know, and placed me into this situation where I was really physically suffering, which was a revelation.
So tell us about this pack. It sounds like it was about 2/3 your body weight.
Yeah.
And you had filled it with everything except the kitchen sink.
Right. Everything except the kitchen sink. You know, people always say, well, how much did it weigh? And I say, well, you know, I didn't have a scale out there, which is sort of surprising, you know. I'm surprised I didn't bring a scale. But it weighed a lot. It weighed so much that when I packed it up, I could not lift it. So I could not lift it even like a centimeter. It was like an unbudgeable thing. In my book, Wild, I say it was actually like trying to lift a Volkswagen Beetle. You know, it looks like you can lift it. It's so tiny and so cute. But could not lift it. And that was the wonderfully humbling moment there of the day one of the journey, because I did have to carry it over 1,100 miles of really rough terrain, and yet I couldn't lift it. And to me, when I was writing the book, that physical experience very much lent itself to the sort of metaphorical question of the memoir, which is how is it that we bear what we cannot bear? Mm-hmm. And I had to do that every day on the PCT. In the case of my pack, it got a nickname, Monster, which because it was so monstrously big. And even though along the way I did lighten my load, I met other hikers who helped me make decisions about what I didn't need and what I needed to keep. And I also, you know, learned some things myself and really did lighten the load. Even then, I still had the biggest, heaviest pack of anyone I encountered on the trail. And, you know, I sort of became famous on the trail as the woman out there with a huge backpack.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me, and I wasn't aware that it worked this way, but you know, you leave your name on logs as you go along and stop in different places, and there were other people who were kind of looking out for you.
Yeah, and I should say not tree logs, like
yeah,
paper logs.
Right.
There are these certain junctures along the way where there's what's called a trail register, and it's in this little metal box, and it's just a notebook, and we would, you know, anyone who passed by would note their name and make some comments about what was happening for them at that moment. You know, if there was water, you know, ahead in the creek or behind, or, you know, if they'd seen a bear or whatever happened. And this became the way that we all communicated with each other on the trail that summer. So oftentimes I would be, you know, walking for days without seeing another human being. And somebody would walk up to me and they would say, "You must be Cheryl Strait."
Hmm.
And it was because they knew that they were following me, that they had read about me.
My guest is author Cheryl Strait. Her new memoir is called Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the new memoir, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail, with its author, Cheryl Strayed. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So, Cheryl, before I read the book and I saw your name on the cover, I thought, well, isn't that a funny coincidence? But in fact, the name Cheryl Strayed is not a coincidence at all.
It's not. It's a name I chose for myself. I was named Cheryl at birth, but Strayed is a new addition. And, you know, when I got divorced from my first husband, I very much felt like as I said earlier, that I needed to recreate myself and redefine myself in the world. And that seemed to me to also necessitate a new name, even though I was suspicious of that. Mm-hmm. You know, in the book I say, you know, I'd sort of mocked people before who had, you know, Susans who had become sequoias, and, you know, Rogers who'd become elks and so forth. And yet here I was realizing that, you know, I couldn't go on with the name that I had. And so I set about finding a new one. And in Wild, I describe very specifically why this particular name was right for me.
Mm-hmm. Did it take a while to feel like it was your name?
It did. The first year or so, I always felt like I was sort of forging a check, you know, every time I wrote that name. But now it's funny. It's been a good while now, and almost, you know, like 17 or 18 years. And I think that it feels more like my name than any name ever did. And, you know, women take on different names all the time when they get married and such. And, you know, that becomes their family name. They identify with it in that deep way. And that's how I feel about Strayed. You know, I would never, somebody asked me once, would you change your name again, or would you give up that name? And no, I feel connected to it in the way that someone feels connected to their name. It feels like my heritage.
You do tell a funny story in the book of a friend who, wanting to support you and your choice, sent you a necklace that was made, and it spelled out Strayed, and nobody could read what it said.
Right. That's right. You know, it was my friend Laura, and she was this jewelry maker. And what happened is the Y, she had to get a Y that was cast from a different mold. It was these silver letters that mm-hmm. strung together to say Strayed. And so she had to get this Y from this other mold. But because it was sort of a fatter letter, it actually looked like a V. So in everyone's mind, I wore this necklace, and everyone who encountered me would say, "Starved? You're starved?" And I was constantly saying, no. But of course, the irony is that I was starved.
Yeah.
You know, I had been walking by then, you know, for many days in the wilderness, and all I thought about was food. I was really like a savage loose upon the land. I say a barbarian loose upon the land in the book, because I felt like, you know, any food offered me, I would have just, you know, eaten, devoured in a second.
So you didn't have a lot of money with you. You would sort of pick up $20 bills as you would stop in different places that you had mailed ahead to yourself. But there are multiple scenes in this book where you are somewhere that food is available, and maybe for the first time in your life you realize that you have to just go hungry unless someone happens to offer.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. I grew up poor and working class. My family never had much money. And while we never went without food, I certainly, you know, I was very familiar with that feeling of not being able to have everything I wanted. And I do think that experience actually allowed me to hike on the Pacific Crest Trail that summer, because I think somebody who always had been very financially comfortable would have known ahead of time, look, this isn't enough money to go do this thing. And, you know, I did have just enough, but I didn't have enough to be comfortable. And so I had to experience a lot of times where I, like you say, you know, I really wanted that cheeseburger at that stop along the way and couldn't because I had 40 cents in my pocket. And I think that was also a part of the journey for me in terms of it being, I think we learn a lot from not getting what we want and mm-hmm. having to sort of struggle harder for it or suffer for it.
And it really is that idea that, you know, the things, you'd be surprised at the things you can survive without.
Absolutely. And two, you know, I think that it was this humbling lesson is in what we actually need versus what we want. And had I had I decided, well, I'll only take this trip if I'm going to be really comfortable and secure taking it, I wouldn't have gone on it. And here I wouldn't have had this, you know, one of the greatest things of my life, you know, aside from marrying my husband and having my kids, hiking to PCT was the best thing I've ever done. And if I had let, you know, money and my ideas of security in relation to money limit me, I wouldn't have done that.
You know, when this book first came in for review, I thought that it was sort of a stunt book, you know, where people decide they're going to do this and they know they're going to write a book. And in fact, you waited a very long time, and it doesn't sound like you began this with the idea of writing a memoir to publish. But have you thought about, like, if you had written it a year later, how different the book would be than what it is today?
Oh, yes. I don't think it would be the book that it is. Uh-huh. I think it would be a very different book. You know, not to knock, I mean, I think that there are some fine memoirs that are written immediately after the experience, but I, for one, do think that the most important pieces to me in Wild are really the meaning that I bring to bear on this experience. And I don't think that I really could have understood it until I grew up, until I had some distance from the time that I took this hike, until I moved further into my life as both a writer and a human. I'm a mother now. I am married to my second husband, and you know, there are a lot of things that I've learned on the journey that, you know, the journey that extended beyond the one I wrote about in Wild, that really allowed me to bring a kind of a deeper consciousness into the story of my youth.
What do you notice about yourself when you go back? Because I know you kept journals as you went along the trail.
Mm-hmm. What do I notice about myself?
Yeah, are there things
you know, it's interesting because I do feel maternal towards myself.
Sure.
You know, I look back at my younger self and I wish that I could go and walk beside myself and say, it's going to be okay, you know, that it's going to be okay, that you can bear this weight that you think you cannot bear, and to be sort of reassuring. I was very hard on myself. I was also very, you know, arrogant and grandiose and self-congratulatory and, you know, all of those things that most of us are in our early 20s. And I would laugh at myself at those things, you know. And so it was very interesting to revisit. You know, there were a lot of times when I was writing Wild, the 26-year-old me or the 22-year-old me, and I would just laugh and shake my head. Hmm. Some of the things, you know, I write about going off to Portland, Oregon, and meeting this young man who was like this really cute punk rocker guy, and he says, you know, hey, have you ever tried heroin? And I say no, and he's like, you should try it, it's really great. And I mean, I shake my head now, but of course back then I thought, well, why not? That does sound like fun, you know. And of course it wasn't really fun in a big way. It was fun in that kind of crazy way that we sort of get caught up in self-destructive things sometimes. And, you know, so I had to shake my head a lot as I wrote, and I had to forgive myself a lot as I wrote, too.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly, you write about the fact that you had people in your life who cared about you that were very worried during this time in your life when you were using heroin and you were sort of involved in relationships that were not healthy. But it seems like, again, and I guess this speaks to being in your 20s, they were lessons that you could not learn except through your own action.
That's right. That's right. And the people who cared about me and who were really trying to help me during that time, you know, they were my friends and my ex-husband. They were people, they were my peers. And they didn't have the power of the parent, really. You know, I think that in retrospect, I think I was really sort of, you know, throwing myself into that fire because I wanted to test. I wanted to test something, and I wanted to be rescued. And of course, the only person who really could have rescued me was a mother or a father, and I didn't have them. And so I, you know, in some ways, I guess now I can see this looking back, is, you know, I ultimately knew I had to rescue myself, like we all do in the end, right? And my hike on the Pacific Crest Trail was my effort at that, my way of trying to do that.
So we see this time and again in Wild. There are lots of ways that PCT hikers can get themselves into trouble. There are wild animals. You can get really sick. You can have an injury. There are sometimes scary strangers along the way. Can you talk about your sort of evolving relationship to your own fear?
Right. Well, when I went out there, I knew before I went that the only way I could go is to decide that I wasn't going to be afraid. If I was going to get out there and let myself think of, that every time I heard a branch snap, that, you know, there was some serial killer coming after me, or if I was going to allow my mind to think about, you know, the rattlesnakes or the bears or the mountain lions, that I would never be able to take 10 steps on that trail.
Mm-hmm.
So I really said to myself, and I do believe that, you know, we do tell ourselves stories, and they affect how we feel about things. And I just went out there and said, I am not afraid. I'm not afraid. It was my mantra. But, you know, as I got deeper into the experience, there's this moment that I write about in Wild where I have to cross this very icy, snowy stretch of the trail. And if I slip, I could fall really off the mountain, or at least at the very best case scenario, crash into rocks far below and injure myself. And I am getting halfway across this icy patch, and suddenly I'm terrified. And it's the first time that I realize, you know, I've come far enough that now I've actually been brave enough to admit to myself that I'm afraid,
mm-hmm.
that I can be vulnerable to this experience. And, you know, there's a lot of things that happen along the way that have to do with me testing again, that word again, where I'm testing my own sort of strength and bravery in the world. And I think that, you know, for me, the ultimate lesson was it wasn't about being brave or being strong. It was about being resilient and figuring out that I could manage each step rather than trying to think of the great scope of what I was doing.
How did books play a role in your sort of experience of the journey?
Well, books have played a role in my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, it comes as no surprise, you know, to me that they were my most treasured items on the trail. I always had a book with me, at least one. And what I figured out pretty early on is I had to do this terrible thing to these books that were really my sacred text.
Yeah.
You know? And that is I had to get rid of the pages as I read them because I didn't want to carry their weight. And so what I did is I burned them. And this was such, you know, a violation of everything I believed. And we all know, right, who burns books, you know?
And, Nazis, yeah.
It was me burning those books.
Right, right. But, you know, it's funny because there's this symbolism of you burning the books and sort of moving past what you have experienced with them. And at the same time, the practical part of me thought, gosh, like a Kindle would have been a really magnificent thing for you to have had with you.
That's right. Well, you know, you bring up a great point. I hiked this trail in 1995. This was, you know, nobody knew what a cell phone was. Nobody had, you know, the internet or, you know, email, or very, very few people did. I certainly didn't. And that has changed the trail significantly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do think that it will always be, you know, difficult and really a challenge to hike the Pacific Crest Trail or the Appalachian Trail or any of those long trails. But now, you know, the hikers I've talked to now, you know, they have their iPhones, they have their iPods, they're listening to music, they have their you know, electronic books and tablets and such. And it does change the experience. They're listening to music as they're hiking the trail. I was listening to nothing but the music in my mind. And, you know, even at each stop, they're emailing people, they're downloading their trail journals onto blogs. And, you know, the way I communicated with people is I sent them a letter from a post office when I encountered one. Every once in a while, I would come to a payphone in one of those little payphone booths and make a call. But otherwise, I was very cut off from others. I had to really invent things to occupy my mind for days and days on end.
So often we use journey as a metaphor, and certainly this is that. But at the same time, you are physically putting one foot in front of the other for 1,100 miles. Your boots did not make it easy.
They didn't. My boots made it very difficult, you know, from the start. And still, the question is, I think, that, you know, my boots were a little bit too small.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that, you know, how much my feet would swell out there, and, you know, I needed more room. And so first, they just rubbed my feet raw. My toes would bump up against the edges when I descended for long distances, and I eventually lost several of my toenails. And even once I got boots the next size up, they still never really fit me right. They never wore the, you know, the boot that were that fit my feet. And I had to suffer a lot in that regard. I think that most long-distance hikers will tell you that your feet are incredibly important, and we're all constantly taking care of our feet, you know, to keep them happy. And some people just never had happy feet. I was one of those people, sadly.
Hmm. And there was one point where you were literally hiking in like socks and masking tape or duct tape.
Duct tape, which is the greatest product known to humans. That's right. I had a little situation where I actually lost my boots. And so I had to create my own shoes out of duct tape. And, you know, they were pretty comfortable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Cheryl Strayed, whose new book is called Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Ms. Strayed. I just happened to hear right when I called in the first time, I think you specified when this trip actually was, which I guess was 1995. I was wondering if you had any insight in the course of your trip or in writing about it later, how many other women had attempted this same trip before you. When I was in college in Portland in the late 80s, a small school called Reed College, I knew a group of women who were planning on hiking the Pacific Crest Trail during the summer, one of those years, and can't quite remember how it turned out, but I was wondering if you did the trip by yourself, or and mm-hmm. if you had heard of many women before you who had attempted the same trip.
Well, thanks for the question. And I live in Portland, Oregon. I love Reed College. I live not far from the college. Yeah, that was really an interesting experience for me, because before I took my trip, I didn't, like I said, it was 95, so there wasn't the internet. I didn't get to really do that sort of research, like who had been on the trail before me. And once I got out there, I mostly met men hiking, and certainly no other solo women. I was alone. But I sometimes would meet women who were hiking with their male partners, boyfriends or husbands, and in a couple cases, women hiking together in pairs. And there is, you know, a sort of sketchy history of, you know, I know several women have gone solo on the trail, but I wasn't aware of them, you know, who had come before me until after I was done with my own trip and did some research. But it is, you know, slightly just less common for people to hike solo at all, and then even more so for women. I didn't really think of it that way when I first went out there. I just felt like I was turning to the trail out of such a sense of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I didn't know I was going to be so alone. I thought I would encounter more people than I did. So I learned a lot once I got out there about being a woman alone.
My guest is author Cheryl Strayed. Her new memoir is called Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Cheryl Strayed. Her new memoir is called Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. When you spoke earlier, Cheryl, about sort of searching for resilience within yourself as you took this trip, it occurs to me that you also had to be pretty flexible, because there were lots of times when things did not go the way you expected. It's sometimes in minor ways, like you would make fewer miles per day than you expected, and then in some very major ways where you had to jump off the trail and jump on at a totally different spot.
That's right, because the year I hiked it turns out there was this tremendous amount of snow that year. I learned that only once I got out there, because I didn't even know enough about mountains and snow to that it didn't occur to me to research it.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I mean, so much, And again, this is maybe, too, where I think writing this memoir all these years later, writing Wild, you know, many years after I took this trip, that I could see, you know, how much of the physical and literal trip evoked a sort of meaning when it comes to the spiritual or emotional or psychological things we face as humans. And that is, you know, just when we think, as we know this, right, just when we think we know what's going to happen next, something else happens, and we have to respond. And we're always making choices about how to respond to that positively or negatively. And I think that, you know, the trail was very much an experience that I was always being thrown something new. And I quickly learned that each day was going to teach me what that day was. And I had to make decisions, you know, based on what I came across on the trail. And so I really found that very interesting as a writer, to be able to use a physical and literal journey as a way of also thinking about life and how we confront those surprises that are thrown at us.
So many writers talk about the sort of agonizing solitude that is required in order to put something together. And it seems that in many ways this was good practice for a career spent at least each day several hours alone writing.
Yes, it is. I've always liked to be alone. And people who know me are sometimes surprised at that, because I'm really an extrovert, too. I'm like a little social butterfly. But I've always loved being alone. And I think, too, that allowed me to decide to take this trip. Many, many people said, well, I would do it, but I would never do it alone. And to me, I felt like that was the only way I could do it. And that's also the place I go when I'm writing. One has to have a very deep solitude in order to create that kind of narrative on the page that's going to be vivid to a reader. And so I've had to get really comfortable with that.
We have an email here from Kelly in Dallas who has a couple of trail-specific questions. How many days or weeks did it take you to stop concentrating on the pain of the pack and terrain? And any guess as to the weight of your fully provisioned pack once you had dumped the extraneous junk?
Those are great questions. You know, it took me a couple weeks. I think of myself as the first few weeks were really, really like coming through a fire, mm-hmm. where I was just absolutely suffering. And then I got used to it. But the funny thing is I never stopped hurting. There was, you know, I was looking at my journal, the journal I kept that summer, and the day before the last day of my trip, I'm writing about how my feet, you know, I had descended a long ways, and my feet were hurting, and I lost my last toenail, you know, that morning. And so I think that, you know, it was never like, oh, okay, now I feel great. I certainly got into shape along the way, and the suffering was somewhat alleviated. But it was always with me. It was always part of the experience. And, you know, I don't know, again, I didn't have a scale. It was certainly not as heavy as when I set out on day one. And mind you, when I set out on day one, I began my hike in the Mojave Desert. So I had to carry all this water. I was carrying 24.5 pounds of water alone. So my pack was always very heavy, you know, heavier than I would bring today. And, you know, now that I have more sort of lightweight values that I've learned over the years. But it was quite heavy. I can only say you wouldn't want to be carrying it.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for the show today. This is interesting. I was a Boy Scout and I did a lot of hiking. I was just curious if you used any kind of source material like that, their manuals or anything. And also, could you tell me like exactly where your journey took you there? I'm not getting the picture yet.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks,
yeah,
Jim.
Thanks for your question. I began in the Mojave Desert near the town of Mojave, California, in Southern California, and went up into the Sierra Nevada all the way through California. I had to skip a big chunk of the high Sierras because there was that big snowpack. And then I hiked on into Oregon and through the entire state of Oregon. I finished my trip at the Columbia River, which forms the border between Oregon and Washington. There's a bridge there called the Bridge of the Gods that crosses the river. And when I touched that bridge, that was the end of my trip. Many people, you know, hike the entire trail. And so by no means, you know, is this a story of saying, you know, I'm the greatest hiker or backpacker. But, you know, for me, it was the journey I needed to take. I hiked about 1,100 miles of the trail. And in terms of source material, I had my guidebook that was the Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, and Volume 2, Oregon and Washington. That was my great resource for that summer. But I had grown up out in the woods. I was a country girl. I grew up in rural northern Minnesota. And so I knew a lot. I knew how to build a fire. My house was, I didn't have electricity or running water or indoor plumbing. And so I knew how to do a lot of things, like that were sort of wilderness things. Apparently, I didn't realize how much that differed from backpacking. You know, a lot of those skills did translate, but many of them didn't. There are very particular things I needed to learn as a backpacker. And the PCT taught me those things over time.
I like when you describe, you know, the friends that you met along the way, and a lot of people looked at you in some ways like, well, what have you gotten yourself into? But no one seems to have been patronizing to you, even when they realized that you didn't know as much as you needed to.
That's right. And that has really struck me, both on the trail and since I've been talking to people about this book. Many hikers go out there for different reasons. You know, some people just go out there because they love to backpack. And those were the people I met along the way who, you know, they knew what they were doing. And they had every reason to look at me and be judgmental and condescending to me. But they weren't. They were kind. They saw that I was, you know, what happens, it's a great equalizer. Because you're all out there, you're doing the same thing. And so there's inherent respect, an inherent sense that we want to be generous with each other and kind to each other. And so if I needed something, they would give it to me. If they needed something, I would give it to them. And what a lot of them gave me was just some knowledge, like, okay, here are some things you maybe don't need to have in your pack. But also mostly just the moral support to say, you're okay, you know, because I knew I was a knucklehead. When I met them, I understood that they knew what they were doing and I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And that was a very, you know, I felt very sort of gulp, you know. And instead of turning around and going home, they said, no, you're doing great. Keep going. And that meant the world to me.
There were a few times along the way where you would stop and you would be able to be in telephone contact with people from your, I'll use air quotes here, real life.
Uh-huh.
What did those interludes mean to you?
Well, they were a strange experience because I wanted to make contact. I would call friends and it was lovely, but it was also very difficult. And I think anyone out there listening who's ever, say, been in the Peace Corps or lived abroad or, you know, been in any sort of situation where suddenly they really are in a different world and living a different life. And it's hard to talk to people back in the quote-unquote real life or back home and really translate the experience. You know, I found myself in those conversations saying, well, it's just amazing, and I can't even really explain. It's just really amazing, you know. And I think that I really wanted to hear what they were doing. But then I would also be filled with a sort of sorrow and nostalgia because I did sometimes feel like, what am I doing out here? You know, I'm 26. It's summertime. I could be having so much more fun.
We have an email here from Kent in Duncanville who wants to know about how you dealt with re-entry once you were done with your trip.
It was easier than I thought it would be. In the last week of my hike, I very much thought, oh, you know, how am I going to do this? Because I both really wanted to get back to my life in the city where I could buy food and listen to music and sleep in a bed and all those things. And I also felt very reluctant to do so because the trail had become my home and such a wonderful place for me. But, you know, so I thought there would be a transition that would be difficult, but I just immediately, you know, exuberantly entered back into the city and, you know, really cozied up into my bedroom and made a home of it and had a fun time. And the trail then, it was so strange because I remember being about a week off the trail and thinking, remembering what it felt like to be out there and feeling like it had been, you know, a year ago when it was only a week. Hmm. It instantly became this foreign land. But it is something I always carried inside of me, too. I mean, it seems like this thing I have in my metaphorical invisible backpack.
Have you been back for a lengthy trip like this?
I've been out backpacking for like 1 or 2 week trips a few times. Not on the PCT, but in on other trails. And I've been on day hikes on the PCT many times because it's not far from my house in Portland, Oregon. But, you know, I have 2 little kids now, and my husband and I have this big plan in a few years when they're maybe 11 and 12 to get them to hike the Washington section of the Pacific Crest Trail with us. I would love to do that.
Mm-hmm. What do your children know about this time in your life?
they know some things. You know, they certainly know about my hike. I have told them that I was married before. I thought this they would be scandalized by that, but they took it in stride.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really feel like with Wild, you know, there is some adult content in the book. And I feel like with my kids, they'll come to the book when they are ready to.
Yeah.
And maybe that'll be when they're 30, you know, because I am their mother. And there might be some things in the book that they won't be crazy about reading. But I think a lot of it, too, in the end, that will allow them to really know me in a way that most of us don't get to know our parents.
Hmm. It also strikes me that as a mother now, it might be hard for you, no matter how resourceful and fantastic your children are, to let them go on a trip like this, even if you know something, the experience would be good for them.
I know. And that is the great challenge of being a parent, isn't it?
Yeah.
We all know, all of us, every one of us listening knows that we have learned from the difficult things. We've learned from our struggles and our mistakes. We've learned from the heartbreaks. And yet none of us want our children to suffer any of them. And so I guess I'm just going to have to do what others have done and learn how to let that go and accept it.
So in the other facet of your writing life, you write an advice column.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar.
And talk about, do you feel like having been through really tough times yourself? Well, first of all, do you think that your early life was relatively speaking harder than most people's?
I think that many people had difficult lives, but I certainly think that I didn't have an easy one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to say, oh, poor me, I had it worse than others, because, you know, I didn't have it worse than many others. But I did have it pretty hard, you know, and I do remember all through my 20s, you know, being very much alone and spending holidays alone and my peers going off into the fold of their families for better or worse. And, you know, so I felt very acutely aware of my status as an orphan in those years. But I don't feel self-pitying about that. I think that absolutely that those experiences helped me, you know, in my life now, and they made me a stronger person. And I certainly bring that into my advice column. It's Dear Sugar on therumpus.net. And I do think that I you know, I give advice from that place of having struggled myself and having also experienced loss and been through those things. I don't write from the position of like, well, this is, I live this perfect life and here's what you should do.
Yeah.
I offer people stories of struggle. And so I've turned those losses into what I think of are my greatest gifts, you know, and I love my mother and I would have her back in a heartbeat, but I have learned so much from her also in her death.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel grateful for that.
Yeah, it comes back again when you mention that you look at your younger self and read through your journals that you wrote, you know, 17 years ago, and you feel a bit maternal. I have to imagine some of that comes through in the advice you give to other people.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of times, you know, I give advice to people of all ages. You know, many times people much older than me will write to me for advice. But I do, you know, especially when I'm giving advice to teens and people in their 20s, I'm acutely aware of myself in their shoes, you know, because I remember what that felt like.
Was writing the book more the final closure than even the trip itself?
Absolutely. You know, there was the trip, and then there, the book was, you know, it allowed me to really go deep sea diving into my psyche and my consciousness to really make sense of, you know, what did that trip really mean in my life, and what did it mean then, and what does it mean now? And that was that's the beauty of writing, is you get to live life twice in some ways, the experience, and then how you make sense of the experience and create a narrative for others to read in hopes that it will, you know, resonate with them as well.
The new memoir by author Cheryl Strayed is called Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Cheryl, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been so wonderful. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Rachel Watts answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.